Following program is furnished by its producer, host, and sponsors.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. We are live in the studios, and you're listening to Health in 30 on WRCR AM 1300 Radio Rockland and live online at WRCR.com. I'm your host, registered nurse Barbara Ficarra. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Gary Sachs about improving the physical health of people with bipolar disorder. Dr. Sachs is the associate professor in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the director of the Bipolar Mood Disorder Program at Massachusetts General Hospital. Call in today with any questions to 845-624-1300. Hi, Dr. Sachs. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Barbara.
First, talk a little bit about the bipolar wellness study that you were a part of.
Well, I think the most important thing to understand about it is why we did it in the first place.
Okay.
And, you know, for some years, we have been aware of the general medical conditions being an issue for our patients. It's important, I think, to understand that in psychiatry, we would focus on what goes with our specialty, such as the risk for suicide. But we have seen that the leading cause of death in patients who have bipolar disorder is really no different in rank order from the general population. So heart disease, stroke, cancer, those are the three leading causes in the general population. But they're not only the three leading causes in our clinic. The risk of dying from one of those general medical conditions is 2 to 3 times higher for our patients than it is in the general population. So we were very aware that there's a very high risk that our patients face for those conditions, and we wanted to see about the awareness and practice of physicians and patients.
And you said it's 2 to 3 times higher in the population of people with bipolar?
That's right. It's a very striking kind of finding, isn't it?
Yeah, that is. That is definitely a high amount. Now, why is that? What was your conclusion?
Well, that in and of itself is really fascinating to think about.
Yeah.
And, of course, it ranges across a number of things that you might say some might be obvious. Because, of course, if you're terribly depressed, not getting out of bed, not going to see your general practice doctor, not having regular checkups, maybe you're neglecting your health, maybe your diet isn't so good. Explanations like that actually don't seem to be the full answer. There may well be some common predisposition that our patients have. And it's interesting to think of the studies that have given us that clue, because what they have looked at is not necessarily the patients themselves, but their first-degree relatives also have higher risk of heart disease, cancer, stroke. So we do need to be aware of it, and we did a survey to look at how doctors perceive this problem, and we got some very good news there. Whether we were talking about psychiatrists or primary care physicians outside of psychiatry, there really was a very good level of awareness of these issues.
Now, do you find between the general practitioners and the psychiatrist that there's open communication between the two specialists, or is it separated?
I'm afraid, as you might have been aware when you asked the question, that people are pretty much practicing in their own little silos, and there's not much communication.
Right. Now, Why is that, though? Why wouldn't there be more communication between the specialists gearing in for what's best for the patient?
Well, I think you know that there's the one level of obstacle to that, which has to do with confidentiality. It would not be seen as appropriate necessarily for me to be calling somebody's primary care doc and to say, do you know how much red meat Joe is eating? You know, and say, you know, are you really aware of how depressed he is? Those traditional barriers, I think, are part of the reason. But there's also, obviously, a time and effort required to do this correctly. And when I do call a primary care doc, I'm calling into his busy practice.
Right.
And he's not necessarily sitting by the phone waiting for me. So we may play tag across several conversations and maybe never get that message out.
Right. So what's the best way for prevention then for the patients with bipolar then if they are in fact seeking treatment from their psychiatrist and from their general practitioner? Both would be preventative in their approach to the patients, but from their standpoint as a patient and from a doctor, what's the best way to get that information to them, though?
I think what we want to do, starting with discussions like we're having, mm-hmm. and including your audience, is by making people aware of it. By having the patients and their supports be aware, we can employ them as active agents on their own behalf. And I think that is the first line of defense for all patients in virtually all circumstances, is the more you know, the more you can take an active role in your care, the more you can ask questions and understand the answers, the better off you're going to be. So if you're going in and you're asking your primary care doc to make sure they let you know, what is your cholesterol? What's your blood pressure been? Are you creeping up with your blood glucose? And what is it that they're worried about? Maybe your thyroid's not quite right. I think just asking those questions puts you in better stead. And with the psychiatrist, when it comes time to prescribe, asking and knowing that not all of the treatments that we have carry the same risk of, let's say, worsening the tendency to gain weight or increase cholesterol. Some really are problematic and some are less problematic.
Now, do patients with bipolar foresee that there is an issue with a potential problem in developing cardiac problems or diabetes? Do they foresee that could be a problem for them, or they are not aware of that?
Well, again, it turns out that over 70% of patients want more information than they're getting.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'd like to have happen through shows like yours is that more people are aware and more people ask. But it's not a responsibility of theirs alone. We can and should be able to do a better job of actively engaging patients in this conversation,
right,
making them aware. And that was an interesting part of the findings of this survey. The majority of both primary care doctors and psychiatrists told us that they were doing a really good job with this. They told us that they were telling the vast majority of their patients. And, you know, it's interesting because I believe that they probably really are doing that job. They are having those conversations. But unlike when you have a conversation with a patient who, let's say, has asthma or mm-hmm. diabetes, right, and you're talking about controlling your diet or exercise, those patients are really in your office quite able to take in the information.
Right.
But if we were talking about a patient in the middle of a heart attack, we would all recognize that that's no time to be talking about diet and exercise.
Right. Mm-hmm.
With somebody who's got major depression, mania or hypomania, we tend to forget that. We're treating something that really is the psychiatric equivalent of a heart attack. And right at the time patients are ill, we will do our education. And I think the message from this study is that that's not an effective approach. We need to engage people more during periods of wellness, which fortunately are the majority of the time. We need to engage their family and other supports. And we probably need to make better use of durable materials so that when patients are at home, they can review a pamphlet or a DVD with their family.
Right. So prevention really is the word that is out there for not only bipolar patients, but for everyone in general, but specifically gearing in towards the bipolar patient, that they may need more educating in terms of prevention.
Barbara, I think we all know that when somebody has gained 40, 60 or more pounds,
right,
that we actually have no effective treatment for that. And yeah, there's no sense kidding ourselves about it. We need to prevent it in the first place.
Right.
And the time to do that is right at the beginning, to have a discussion, to include the fact that it would be wise to regularly monitor weights and to make a change in treatment if somebody gains 5-10 pounds in a month. We shouldn't be watching over that month after month for 6 or 7 months.
And is medication does that cause the weight gain in a lot of the cases with the bipolar patients?
Well, that word you use, cause, is also a little bit tricky.
Okay.
Because, you know, people will start to think, oh, this is a molecule that's just going to jam the pounds on. And actually, most of the medications that we use have slight or sometimes no real metabolic effect per se. They don't change the way you burn calories, but they may make it so that you're a little bit less active. They may actually increase your appetite and maybe specifically increase it for some of the less healthy carbohydrate-rich kinds of foods. So if you took the average person who was reasonably active and you turned them into a couch potato without changing their diet, that person would gain 30, 35 pounds a year.
Okay.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
And so if our medications took somebody from being reasonably active down to the level of mainly sitting around without any of the other metabolic issues that might be going on in some instances, we would expect people to gain weight.
Okay. So it's possible, though, that they can be in great shape, anyone, really, if they get out there, eat right, and exercise. It's just giving that message of prevention and education in terms of keeping healthy.
It can be as simple as that. And for our patients, we will watch over and we will say, let's see, if you gain as much as 2-3 pounds in a week or two, what I want you to do, and we'll give them a very simple recommendation for adding brisk walking every morning. So go outside your door after breakfast, walk 7.5 minutes briskly in whatever direction you like, turn around and walk back 7.5 minutes. If you did that every morning, you would really cut down the risk that you'll gain weight. And of course, if you begin to gain weight, it's even wiser to do it not just at breakfast, but right at dinner.
Right.
So then you would be adding a half an hour of vigorous walking, and that alone will help you get over the hump of having an excessive amount of calories taken in versus burnt to the other side. If you're just a little bit on the side of burning more than you take in, gradually you lose weight, and it's a wonderful cumulative effect if you can make that a kind of lifestyle habit.
Right. So that's really great, though, that you're giving that information to your patients, and now really the word is to spread that to everyone else out there who's treating patients, that really you need to teach prevention and what they can do in short-term goals, too, that can accomplish that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What else would the study did you find? It's really interesting.
If people are interested in the details of study findings, mm-hmm. or some of these other steps they could take for physical health, they could visit mysimplemeasures.com. That's all one word.
Oh, okay.
And there's some nice tips there. There are plenty of other web-based resources that people can look at. And I think almost always that's going to be beneficial because as much as you may know, there's always a trick or two out there that can be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many ways to do this. I think the combination of both diet and exercise, you know, to a moderate extent, is really pretty much what everybody would benefit from. And very few people need much more than that.
And the risk with developing diabetes with being overweight, too, increases.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
As you have your weight go up, you're at increased risk for diabetes. And again, there are reasons to believe that people with certain severe mental disorders, like bipolar disorder and mm-hmm. schizophrenia, are probably at higher risk than the general population.
Right.
And we don't really understand why that is, but that's a finding across several studies now.
Now, do doctors, or is there any type of pamphlets out there from any organization that gears in towards this that they give to their patients?
Maybe there are a couple of patient advocacy groups mm-hmm. That do have information about this. The Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance, or DBSA, they have excellent information. The National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, or NAMI, also has excellent information. The National Institute of Mental Health has a website as well with plenty of very good information. So any of those sources, I would say, are excellent.
Okay. We always talk actually on the show about prevention and healthy eating and diet and exercise. Well, not diet in the sense of eating healthy. And it just goes across the board with no matter what your diagnosis is, no matter what your disorder is, everyone really needs to jump on board with being healthy and eating right and exercising, and it can prevent a lot of things from developing.
You know, Barbara, the way you've said that, I hope it doesn't come across to people as, well, of course, you know, blah, 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 you say do healthy stuff. But it really does appear when we now have data, not just from these sorts of epidemiological studies showing different health risks, but also, you know, as you start to look at some of the results from the genetic studies that are done, it really does look like some of the risk factors for heart disease, high blood pressure, stroke, et cetera, these are common across disorders. And you can alter your risk with your lifestyle. So I think you're absolutely right. And it's not just, can I lower my risk of diabetes? But maybe I can extend my life and my quality of life because I'll also lessen the risk of getting arthritis, lessen the risk of having heart failure. Those are really important health advantages, I think, for all of us to take note of.
Right. And for the listeners, too, even for anyone out there listening, it's always a good idea, too, to write down things before they go to their doctor and ask a lot of questions. And, I mean, even if they have space to write their blood pressure down and their weight and cholesterol, this way they could jot all the important information down that they need to know and know what they need to work on, and maybe kind of even keep a log of their exercise habits to try to help them along with maintaining their weight or
let me reinforce that point. If you go to your doctor and you're relying on kind of chronic undifferentiated chat to get across all the points that are important to you, you're at a great disadvantage than if you come with a written piece of information that you're going to review. All those things that are important to you, those are the things that you forget as soon as you walk in the doctor's office.
Right, yeah.
So being able to take out your notes and say, yeah, I wanted to talk to you about these three, four very important things, I think that's great advice.
Right. And the time should be taken with it. I would imagine if any healthcare provider would kind of push it to the side and not want to ask you those questions, then that wouldn't be such a good thing.
it may not be such a good thing, but I think when they hear that you're interested and you're prepared, certainly you're going to get a much higher quality experience. If you find out that you're doing that and your doctor is not responsive to that kind of collaborative approach, you may well want to find an alternative.
Exactly right, yes. Because it's important to have open communication between you and your healthcare provider, your doctor, or whoever you're seeing.
No substitute for somebody who will listen to you.
Right, exactly. So what else are you saying then? Now, is this something that you always were a proponent of, gearing towards prevention with your patients, or was it really once you really saw the results from the study that it kind of happened?
Well, I think, as I said before, we did the study because we already had an inkling of this.
Right.
You know, we see the problems of obesity in our clinic. We see most of the ills of society in our patients, and you wonder, are we seeing it more than in the general population? As it has turned out, we are. Now, there's also some very good news, not from this particular study, but from others.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, a colleague in Switzerland, Jules Anx, has tracked people over several decades and looked at the impact of whether you got treated or not on the death rates from these different conditions. And it turns out being in any kind of effective treatment not only lessens the likelihood that you'll have depression or mania, not only cuts the rate of suicide, but lowers death rates from all causes by about 50%. That really is dramatically good news. So making sure that you go in, you get treated, you stay in treatment, and you will see that death rates due to cancer, heart disease, and stroke go down.
Right.
That is an amazing sort of finding.
And what was that study, did you say?
This is a study done by a Swiss researcher named Jules Anx.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Now, if a patient goes to their general practitioner and is at risk, say, for developing diabetes because they, through their blood test, it noted to be high, Does the general practitioner then send that patient to an endocrinologist, or do they continue seeing and treating that patient?
You know, I think it would depend on a couple of different things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether we're just over into the barely worrisome kind of range, or, you know, if I found that somebody had what we called malignant hypertension, they would actually go to the emergency room right away.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If I found that their lipids were, their fat in their blood was just a little bit elevated, there are probably things that I could do, maybe things that the general practice doctor would be happy to do. But at a certain level, we actually refer them to a specialized clinic at our hospital for
mm-hmm.
that. So there are such specialized clinics that take care of high blood fat, or what we call hyperlipidemia. So at some level, yes, specialty care is involved. But for the most part, primary care docs are prepared to manage mild to moderate issues along these metabolic problems.
Okay. And in regards, I know I keep going back to the study, but it was such an interesting study. What else would you highlight from that? It's definitely a higher population with patients with bipolar II that can develop these metabolic and cardiac problems. And is that, do you know why that is, though? Or
we actually don't know why it is, but mm-hmm. the study found that a third of patients were not at all aware that some of the medications were associated with raising blood sugar, blood pressure, or cholesterol. Again, that really is mm-hmm. a striking finding by itself. But mm-hmm. also, less than half the patients actually had screening tests done on their blood for high cholesterol or blood glucose levels.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have that, you don't know whether medications are affecting you. And we really think routine monitoring is important. And in fact, most of the national guidelines, not just in the U.S., but around the world, recommend doing these things. Doctors often say they are doing it, and for some reason, it's not getting done.
Now, routine monitoring, what would that be? Do you mean maybe every 6 months?
Well, it would mean that
or?
When we start a patient with medication,
mm-hmm.
If we haven't recently got them on a scale, we'll measure their weight, we'll send them to the lab, and we'll know what their cholesterol is at the start.
Okay.
Right? We'll know what their blood glucose is. And if a month or two or three later, we see the trend is that they're creeping up, before we get into anything serious, maybe we could choose a different treatment. Maybe we could have a discussion at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
if you're already on the high side, about what some of the healthier options might be in terms of particular medication.
Right. So as a psychiatrist, though, you are gearing in towards their physical health, though, through routine blood work, keeping track of that. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a great thing. Do all psychiatrists do? I'm hoping. I don't know if I'm asking the question right, because I shouldn't use the word all, but
I think it is part of the guidelines for routine care.
Okay.
And so, you know, we did look and see how often this actually gets done in our own clinic,
mm-hmm.
and it isn't really as easy to do this as I may have made it sound,
mm-hmm.
Because you'll hand somebody the lab slips, and they'll even say yes, and they don't make it to the lab.
Right.
Well,
mm-hmm.
in the case of our clinic, we're in one building at Mass General Hospital, and the actual lab where you get your blood drawn is a block and a half away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't sound like much, but it is a major obstacle. I think if we had the blood drawing facility right in the clinic, we would do a better job. And in fact, when we looked at our results, we decided we have to do that. So we're adding that facility to our clinic.
Right.
So we can get this done at a higher rate.
Right. Well, that makes sense. It's just easier for the patient just to go right there instead of going somewhere else.
It really is.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get there and there's a long line, and
right.
you know, you decide you don't really want to do it anyway, and maybe you didn't want to tell the doctor you hate needles, and lots of reasons can come up.
Right. Now, you had briefly just mentioned a little bit about the medications may be causing the elevated blood sugars. Is that?
Yes.
Does that happen?
There is a risk with mm-hmm. some of the drugs. These are drugs that have been, in many cases, also approved for treatment of schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And in that population, a lot more study has been done, and we can see that there is an increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes with these kinds of drugs.
Right. But if the patient does eat a healthy diet, though, right, that could be alleviated.
Almost all of this is associated with weight gain.
Mm-hmm.
So there may be rare exceptions to that, but for the most part, you can really protect yourself, again, by not waiting until you've gained 40, 60, 80 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm just curious with the study, did it delve into at all the eating habits of the patients that were that took the study, to see what they ate or?
Yeah, we didn't ask specifically what people ate, but we did ask them if they were aware mm-hmm. of the choices about diet and portion control. And again, a pretty large percentage of people said they weren't at all aware of that.
That's so interesting. That's really interesting because, but the message of prevention, though, just in general out there for the whole general public, isn't where it should be, though, either. So maybe I'm not so surprised, though.
And maybe it takes more than the message.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are things about our lifestyle as a country that maybe undermine that message.
Right.
And, it would be great to think that our children or grandchildren will live in a different world. But for the world that we have right now, I think it's not so easy when you're constantly being bombarded with opportunities to do things that may not be the healthiest.
Right, yes.
Whether that's dietary, whether it's staying up late at night, whether it's choices about use of drugs or alcohol. These are things that require you to get it right almost every time.
Right.
And when you start getting it wrong,
mm-hmm.
you can slide back fast.
Right. And just in terms of dietary, it's so easy just to go into a supermarket and be bombarded with all the sugar that's a culprit in weight gain, just from the cereals alone and the high fructose corn syrup that's used in so many products that shouldn't even be in there. I mean, it is an easy avenue to gain, if you really don't focus on trying to maintain a weight or try to lose weight, it's easy to eat things that are not healthy for you. And yeah, I think prevention really has to be somehow developed more in terms of healthy eating habits.
Yeah, I think there was a time where people didn't think much of, dropping pieces of litter on the street. And since the Keep America Beautiful campaign came in,
yeah.
you can see there's a change in our culture for the better. There really were times where people thought, why in the world do I need to buckle my seatbelt? And now I think we really need to pay attention to things like diet and other elements of lifestyle that are healthier for us and our family.
Exactly. In about 30 seconds, do you want to sum up quickly
and
for the listeners out there?
The summary of what we found mm-hmm. is that there are high levels of awareness of general medical risks among bipolar patients. And among their care providers, but that the communication about them from doctor to patient really could be improved, that there's a big role for prevention and for being an active participant in your own care. So learning more and asking lots of questions are in your interest.
Great. Thank you. And a website, StepBD, right, .org has information?
Our website is actually www.manicdepressive.org.
Oh, okay.
StepBD has information about a particular study we did.
Okay.
And mysimplemeasures.com is the one about this survey.
Okay, great. Dr. Gary Sachs, thank you so very much for joining us and sharing your expertise and the study with us. Thank you
My
so
pleasure,
very much.
Barbara.
Chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, is a serious medical condition that can be overlooked because it mimics so many other disorders. At least 1 million Americans are affected by CFS, yet less than 20% have been diagnosed. The severity of CFS varies greatly from patient to patient, with some people being able to maintain an active, healthy life. For others, it has a profound effect on their work, school, and family. According to the CDC, 25% of patients are disabled by the illness. You can get more information at cdc.gov/CFS. And the Faces of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome is now in Penn Station. It's displayed in the Amtrak's main concourse from August 6th to the 13th. It's a compelling exhibit featuring the portraits of stories of CFS patients, families, and members of the healthcare professional team. And on Saturday, August 11th, from 10 to 2 at the Pearl River Hilton, there will be a blood and bone marrow drive. Eileen McCabe is the coordinator. Call Eileen at 845-359-3927 for more info. And finally, next week, we lighten things up a bit. Joining us is celebrity chef John Aston. He'll be here to talk. And at Flavor and Frontier Day, he'll give you
AM 1300
information on how to...
Spring Valley.
AP. Five are known dead in Minneapolis bridge collapse. The murky, swirling waters.
About what we're doing and trying to be slow so we don't hurt anybody. So it's going to be several days.
Rosenberg.